Suncast is brought to you by SunGrow, providing clean power for all. Suncast is also brought to you by Trina Solar.
Not using anything at all is better than using something. Wind, oh, yeah. Solar, oil, gas. If you're able to do it and not use anything, that will always be better than generating. It just will. So our goal is to, one, make sure that we have policies in place that allow that to happen for all people, all consumers, every walk of life. And that's really what my mantra is at the federal level. And then it is to get people to see value in not using a resource.
Hey there, solar warriors. I'm Nico Johnson, and this is Suncast. Each week, I pull back the veil on the life and business insights of clean tech entrepreneurs building the most noble and impactful companies of our time. I hope what you learn from this conversation is a catalyst for your own growth. So thanks for tuning in and welcome to our tribe. Hey, welcome back, Solar Warriors. If you are new here, I'd like to say welcome in and thank you for giving us the only non-renewable resource you possess. Of course, that is your time. You're also paying one thing that I am super grateful for and that you didn't have to give, and that's your attention. So if you'll stick with us for the next 60 plus minutes, I promise we'll give you a return on that investment. Every week, I get a chance to have a conversation with leaders on the front lines of the clean energy transition, leaders making a difference in the world. And you'll hopefully note that we are in the middle of Women's History Month. And while we don't reserve Women's History Month as the only time that we bring in diverse women voices across the industry, we do carve out the entire month for strong leadership and examples of how to build a career with meaning and folks that you can look to if you, as a female or a minority, are trying to find examples that people that look like me that do things like this. You're in the right place. If you are unfamiliar with today's guest, Paula Glover has served as the president for the Alliance to Save Energy since 2021. She's a dynamic leader with more than 25 years of experience in the energy sector. She's driven by the belief that universal adoption of energy efficiency is foundational to achieving energy affordability, economic growth, and decarbonization. And she's helped secure billions of dollars in government funding to take programs to market that do just that. She's also previously served as president and CEO of the American Association of Blacks in Energy. Perhaps you heard her past episode where we did go back into her backstory. I'll link to that all the way back in 2020. I'm sure that some of you've heard it. Many of you probably haven't because you're new here. But I would encourage you to go back and listen to that episode as well. We go deep into the why of the work that she was doing at ABE, which is a nonprofit focused on ensuring African Americans and other minorities have input into the decisions and development of our energy policy, regulations, and environmental issues. You see, over the past 15 plus years in particular, Paula has dedicated her life to helping the energy sector, petroleum and other, through work with state legislators and regulators. She's developed a clear understanding of the consumer, the community sides of the business, really understands how we're navigating this energy transition. So today's conversation, I am sure, is going to get raw. I am sure you're going to learn from it. Get ready to tap into your heart side of leadership. And I invite you along. If you haven't subscribed to the show, please do that so you don't miss out on our twice weekly content just like this. Hopefully, you've had a chance to listen to another conversation that I've had with Paula as well. If it has been published already, that is a vignette on finding your secret sauce. If not, it's soon to come. Of course, you can check out nearly 700 additional clean energy founder stories and startup advice just like this over at mysuncast.com. But for now, let's get ready to tune up your skills, Solar Warrior, as we tune into another powerful conversation here on Suncast. Paula, it's a long time coming, and it's great to have you back on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. Mm-hmm. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. My hair was long and your hair was short the last time.
I know.
The last time we were on.
I have hair magic. It's all over the place.
I hope that we are able to give folks an interesting look into the world of Paula Glover. Before we do so, I like to start off with quotes, because I think that quotes from famous people or leaders, or maybe not so famous, but inspirational ideas can help guide us. They give us a sense of the past. I'll bring in one. They just sort of rotate on my desktop, and I'm glad this one came up because it talks a lot to what you and I've been talking about over the past few weeks. It's another fellow African-American leader, one Bill Cosby. And he said, "I don't know the key to success, but the key to failure is trying to please everybody."
Oof. Well, now that is an entire sermon.
It is.
Right there in a sentence.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would say he's preaching a word. Yeah. Mm. Oof.
Is there anything like that quote that comes up for you or that you routinely share as inspirational words from someone that you admire?
Yeah. You know, something recently that I heard that has been sticking with me and I've been thinking about deeply is something that actually Al Sharpton said, which was, don't let this moment take from the movement. Something like, you know, right? So that we're in a moment, but really what we need is a movement. And we should not mix those two things up and think that this moment in time is really the movement for progress. And, you know, I think it resonated with me in a couple of ways. One, just thinking about the political environment that we are in now and all that is going on. But even as we think about this transition and how we talk about it as a moment in time, when what I desire is for this to be a starting point.
Yeah.
Right. This is just a starting point of us doing things differently in perpetuity. Not like, oh, we're addressing this because we have this new administration. And so in this moment, we're doing this thing and then we move on from it.
Brief four-year window.
Yes, which is really like 3 years once everybody's settled up and in and out.
That's
and
right.
Stuff. Yeah, so that's a quote that I think has really sat with me.
I'll probably reuse that one in a year where we're going to see a lot of moments that could potentially distract from or distract from the movement.
I mean, I might suggest that when we met in 2020, we were in the middle of a moment.
Ain't that the truth?
That became a movement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what maybe our worry is that the movement is over. But right, but movement by virtue of the word, it's constant.
Yeah.
It's constant. I kind of feel like it's constant.
Because I fly a lot. Kind of feel like the difference is for years we were sort of, dragging heavy luggage through the airport. And then like the Biden administration came in and it felt like we stepped on that moving escalator. And some people stopped and they stood on it and it like continued to carry them, right? The momentum of that machine. And others like you and me, we were sprinting. We're like, sweet, I can get there faster. Yeah.
Right.
And, regardless of what happens, maybe the Biden administration changes to some other administration and we will get off the escalator or get off the moving escalator. We still got to keep walking, right? Still got luggage to move. Still got a place to be and destination. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll get into more of the transition you've made since the last time we had you on the show. But I want to give folks who are unfamiliar at a macro level, how do you describe the problem generally that you're trying to solve?
Yeah. So I think for the Alliance, the problem that I am trying to solve, and I'll give you a bit of the why, right? So the problem that I'm trying to solve is that I believe energy transition, no energy transition. We should be centering energy efficiency, this idea of energy conservation, and just not being wasteful. Mm-hmm. And those are really... That's a really strong principle when you think about efficiency, right? The efficient use of our time. We're talking about the efficient use of energy, the efficient use, like that's what we're talking about. And so for me, I want people to see that not using anything at all is better than using something. Wind, solar, oil, gas. If you're able to do it and not use anything, that will always be better than generating. It just will. And so our goal is to, one, make sure that we have policies in place that allow that to happen for all people, all consumers, every walk of life. And that's really what my mantra is at the federal level. And then it is to, right, get people to see value in not using a resource. So we'll call it the first fuel. And it's hard for people to kind of understand because it isn't a fuel, really. Technically, it's not a fuel, but it's the first because we're saying you don't actually have to use anything. But it also, I think, you know, why I like this work, really enjoy this work, is that efficiency also has multiple ways that it can benefit us in our economy, If you are talking about just affordability and energy burden, right? Reducing how much people use is a way to reduce burden. It just is. If you're talking about security, energy security, and people getting shut off notices, reducing the amount that people use also helps reduce the amount of their bills and may prevent future shutoffs. If you talk about energy poverty and customers who don't use heat when they need it or air when they need it because it's so expensive, having efficient systems in place that will not only keep them comfortable, but will cost less actually helps that problem, right?
That's right.
And then, you know, the larger conversation about employment and workforce and the opportunities that this business creates, this sector creates. And, you know, I love to remind people that, you know, 2.1 million people live work in energy efficiency. We are the largest employer of this sector.
Wow.
And our jobs exist in 99.6 counties in the United States because they're plumbers and electricians and energy auditors. And, you know, a lot of these construction, they're in your house. They're installing doors and windows and put piping and insulation in between your walls. And we're also manufacturing heat pumps and building digital twins and all of these things. Are part of the efficiency landscape and world.
And you so said 2.6
so
million?
Much opportunity. 2.1 million people. According to E for the Future, 2.1 million people, I think as the end of 2022, worked at energy efficiency.
Wow.
We are the largest employer.
How does ASE work with other organizations like AESP, our friend Jen Sorrow, and IREC, and some of the other organizations that do focus on helping utilities think about their energy policy or helping consumers with better programs? How do you guys all work together?
Yeah. So we work closely. We are a membership association. So we have many of the trades are also members of my association, as well as large companies, as well as utility companies, really broad gamut. And so, right, we're working one towards identifying policies that are going to allow for the advancement of energy efficiency at the residential, the consumer, and the industrial level. We care deeply about demand response. We care deeply about, you know, rapid adoption and mass adoption of Energy Star appliances. And so we're all working together to make those things happen. But most importantly for the Alliance, we ask lots of questions that really start with, like, who isn't here? What don't I know? And please tell me what's the problem with this idea, right? We never assume that what we are suggesting is the end all be all solution. We really want to have a lot of robust dialogue from people who agree with us and people who completely disagree with us. Because at the end of the day, we are trying to get really strong policy that will not be moved, you know, that stays solid no matter what administration is in place. It's doing the right thing for the right reasons, for all people. And so we take a really deliberate approach at trying to bring as many people in as possible. Right now we have two big projects that we do that with. One is called Energy 2040. And that really is, what is the role that energy efficiency is going to play to hit our climate goals? 2040, 2050 and beyond. And then the other is active efficiency, which really does focus on the digitization of energy. And right, all of these sensors and things that we want to have, right, grid-enabled buildings and all this stuff, all of that is part of our world. And we need to understand, you know, what the technology is, what technology is available to us, how do we use it, where can it be adopted, but also what are the challenges with that, right? So one example would be, and so grateful with this, you know, the investment coming out of IRA was that if you don't have broadband everywhere, right, a lot of this technology cannot be adopted in places where you don't have access to broadband because we're using controls and sensors and we're digitizing. We need to, this is all data. And so having this investment in broadband in communities across the country actually helps advance energy efficiency in a way that could not be advanced absent that kind of investment. And so for the Alliance,
because of IoT?
Yes, because if you're talking about smart meters, or right, your coffee maker that's smart that can turn on and do all the things, you still need access to internet to do that. So if I live in a rural place of the country and I don't have access to internet, I can't have all this other stuff. And so it's really, you know, for us as the Alliance, we start thinking about, like, what is the enabling technology? We really do take a systems thinking approach so that we understand what's missing, what is that gap. And then finally, the thing that we're doing at the Alliance is once we're able, we have a policy that we support, our policies in place, we don't just assume that it works and then there's nothing to see here and we don't have to worry about it, because we do believe that these goals are big goals and we have a very short time frame. And so we do want to make sure that the policies, not only that we've advocated for, but that the policies that are in place are actually doing the things that they are designed to do. And if they're not, then what's the pivot, right? You got to have a, you have to have a plan, because what we cannot afford is to get to 2030, 2040, 2050, and then discover that these things did not work, right? At that point, it's kind of too late. And so there has to be a constant kind of just double check. Is this doing, you know, is 40% of the benefit going XYZ? Are we seeing, right? We just have to kind of continue to do that. And then understand what's new, because you know, it's not a transition where you start one place and then we transition, we end someplace else. I actually think it's a constant.
Constant evolution.
Constant rolling. So we always have to kind of be on top of it.
Yeah, it's funny. We come up with these coined phrases like the energy transition, and they serve a purpose, but then they outlive their purpose often.
Hey, if you're looking for a way to maximize the ROI for your next utility project, I would like to point you to Sungrow's new SG4400 modular inverter. This new innovative solution will reduce capital and operating expenses because it arrives already on a skid with a step-up transformer. It's built using four 1100 kW modules so that if one of them fails, well, the other three keep powering right on through, as the DC and AC protection are completely separate between the modules. You can learn more about this fantastic new product and more at mysuncast.com/sungrow.
Within the context as a nonprofit organization, membership-based organization, who do you work for? Who's your customer?
I mean, I would say as a membership-based organization, my customer are my members. Mm-hmm. I think but here's the rub, because I think, you know, it sounds like, okay, well then all you do is what companies want you to do. But what companies want me to do is with intent, right? We are intentionally, we want energy efficiency and we want it in a bipartisan way, right? We have a mission and it, you know, it kind of outlines, but also like I was hired because I work in a particular kind of way. And every organization, when they're hiring leaders, other people, you're bringing them in, not just for the skills and what they've done before, but also what you desire them to do. And part of that is understanding kind of how do they prioritize the work? How are they thinking about it? Right. How do they think about vision and growth of a nonprofit organization? And is that in alignment, right, with the desires of your board, which in my case is representative of my membership? And so I feel really comfortable in saying that, yes, I am doing the work that my members desire, but I also influence the desires of my members. And so, and what I mean by that is, you know, I came in and really interesting at a time where you hear all this inkling around anti-DEI, you know, I came into an organization, who had had an interest and a priority around doing energy justice. But also being able to say, here's where I think we're going to be challenged by this work. Here's where I think it's going to be hard. It's not going to be easy as we think. And they still allow me to push through. Right. And so there had to be, right, the members had to agree to that because they are my bosses. They are my board. You know, I don't just get to do whatever the heck I want.
It's interesting. They're both your customer and your boss, right?
They're my customer and they are my boss.
What's the makeup of the membership of the Alliance?
I mean, our Alliance is corporate members. So think the Schneiders, the Carriers, the Honeywells, the Johnson Controls, the NRDCs, the utilities, Southern California Edison, Comet, you know, so it really does. It's a huge thing. And then the tech companies, Willow, Microsoft, Google. So it's a very broad membership, which makes the work actually, I think, more enjoyable, but a lot harder because we have to have consensus.
How to use a nonprofit and sort of bridge builder for divining consensus among the various competitors, i.e. stakeholders in the industry. Mm-hmm. How are you involved in helping things like investment in broadband or bringing heat pumps to market. I mentioned in the intro that you brought billions of dollars in funding for efficiency mm-hmm. programs. But how does an organization like ASE specifically, like how do you actually effectuate that change?
So what we do in those kinds of changes is, right, in this particular scenario, you have an administration and members of Congress who came up with a suite of bills and priorities. Mm. And as an alliance, our job then is to educate, right, our members of Congress and the administration mm-hmm. about the impacts of the ideas, things that we love. And quite frankly, there may be some things that we don't like. But we have to educate, and that takes a lot of work, right? You have to, because you can't just educate when something is happening, right? It's about building a long-standing relationship so that when nothing is happening, you can still be a resource for information, because right? The industry has information to share, and we should be a resource to our policymakers with what we have, just like our advocates should, our environmental justice, like everybody. We all have this opportunity to be a resource because these are legislators who work for us, right? Ideally, us as a country, they work for us as members of this greater society. But it's unreasonable to think that somebody gets elected to office and they know everything about everything. Yeah. That's unreasonable. Like if I got elected to office, there's no way someone should expect that I would know everything about healthcare. How? I've never worked in healthcare. I have no real acclimation other than I go to the doctor. And so our role as a nonprofit, as an alliance, as an advocacy organization is to educate our members of Congress about the issues that we care about and how the impact of that decision making, so that mm-hmm. what you hope is that they'll make a good decision for their constituents, the best right. possible decision they can, given the information that we have. So our role was to, right, look at these bills and talk about, here is the benefit, or here's the impact of tax credits. And if you expand a 25C tax credit, here's what we believe can happen with the greater adoption of energy efficiency in people's homes, or, you know, efficiency in buildings, et cetera. Here's what we believe can happen if you have a tax credit for heat pumps, for example. But to my early point, but then there comes the result piece of this, right? So we have our tax credits, we have a suite of financial tools and opportunities for large businesses, small businesses, individual residential consumers to take advantage of efficiency. If they do not, it is our responsibility as the alliance to understand why that is. Is that because people don't know about it? Is it because it's not enough money? Is it because, like, I don't know why, right? And I don't know that that's even the case. But to do the work well, I actually have to know what happens after the bill has been enacted, after these tools are made available to the public. If it does not work out the way that I'm thinking it's going to work out, then we need to understand what happened there, right? Yeah. What did we miss? And so, you know, but our job is just constantly educating and understanding wherever other people come from, right? Doing it in a vacuum and ignoring the opinions of others, particularly those who disagree with you, does not serve you well. Just doesn't. You don't know what someone else is saying. You know, it just does not work. And, you know, early in my career, I was a state lobbyist. And I learned one of the first things I learned was, like, from other lobbyists, was that to be effective, you need to know what your company wants and needs, and you need to understand what the other guy wants and needs.
Yeah.
Right. And you need to be able to articulate that in an honest way. Right. Because how are you going to make a compelling case if you do not understand the other side? You can't really make a compelling case, right? All you can do is then throw around rhetoric because you have not taken the time to understand what the other side's concerns are. You know, if we want to have long-lasting, sustainable change, we actually don't have time for rhetoric. We only have time for understanding the other side so that we can come up with solutions that work for most people. May not work for everybody, but what you hope is that you come up with something that works for most folks, or at least doesn't make it worse for folks who are already suffering, right? Like, we should at least be able to make that commitment and promise that we're not going to make your lives any harder than we already have.
The work that the Alliance has been engaged in since being founded by two U.S. senators back in 1977 has been, by and large, I'd say characterized as developing, vetting, advocating bipartisan policy. As a nonprofit, I kind of have two questions. The first is, how's it funded? And then the second, which is along the same lines, is, do you consider it as a former lobbyist, do you consider the Alliance and organizations like it lobbying organizations or pseudo lobbying organizations?
I don't. I do think that there's a difference between lobbying, right? Which is writing the bill, write the bill, hand it to the member of Congress, review the bill, tell them what we like, what we don't like, rewrite it, da da da. We don't do all of that, right? Right. There's a really hard line between like kind of educating and advocating and real lobbying. Yeah. And that difference is actually very, very important, right?
Yeah.
I don't have a PAC. I don't give money, right? We don't give money to members who are running. We don't endorse people who are running. Mm-hmm. We don't get involved in the election cycle. But we have, by design, as you noted, we are a bipartisan coalition. We actually have a bipartisan bicameral honorary board of advisors to keep us honest, right? Yeah. To ensure that in some ways that we do not do that, right? That we do not just focus on one side of the story and not the other, right? It is foundational to the way that we were founded as an organization that we need to be collaborative and that we have to understand and bring together both sides because we want long-lasting solutions. And I just happen to be a person, maybe because I am a Black woman, who actually believes that that's the only way things happen that stick. Because my life experience tells me is that is the only way things happen that stick. Yeah. You know, that if you can't get people to agree, someone is going to be hurt on the other side of that.
And so it's funded then through membership fees, membership dues, basically.
Yeah. So we have some membership dues, but we actually have also an education program. So a good portion of my funding actually comes through my ed program. So we have what we call an empowered school program. We operate in 300 schools across the country, and we just do energy education, efficiency education, the students. And some schools do energy audits of their schools. They come up with projects that can demonstrate how much they can save in a school by switching out the lights or whatever that particular project is. They take on those projects and we measure, those successes. And so that is that, you know, in addition to that program, that the funding that comes in for that program, it absolutely helps us run the organization. Yeah. Then we do have.
That's cool. And that's grant funded, I assume.
Sometimes grant funded. Yeah. I mean, but sometimes companies, utilities will say, you know what? I want to do environmental justice education in my school system. And they will hire us to do environmental justice education in their school system. And we have teachers on staff. So we design our own curriculum. That curriculum always meets with state standards. If it's Common Core or something else, it is a pure education program so that students understand energy and specifically for us, energy efficiency and the power of efficiency, and then bring those tools home to their families and to their community so that other people are like doing these kinds of things.
You get a chance to see, interact with by the nature of both your members as well as just the access to what's happening in the market, a lot of the technology that is being vetted for the market, I suppose I would say. A lot of folks listening are either in the solar industry or considering being in the solar battery storage or home electrification sector. What insight might they glean from the work that you guys are doing that yields sort of your thoughts around interesting opportunities right now in energy efficiency, your home envelope, or where you see the industry headed that service professionals might want to spend more time thinking about?
So I would say probably one of the biggest areas that your listeners may really want to pay attention to is around resiliency and where there's funding and money, where's money going? So one example that I always use, because it's something that I think I'm very proud of, is, you know, the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund, which is $27 billion, $7 billion, I think, is for Solar for All. And then $20 billion is broken up between a clean accelerator and another program. But it identifies energy efficiency as an enabling technology. And so what that means is if you have a developer who wants to install rooftop or build community solar in a particular neighborhood, you do have to do efficiency first, particularly in low and disadvantaged communities, because what you do not want is people building systems that are bigger than they actually need, right? That goes to our earlier conversation around energy poverty and burden and these other problems, societal problems that we are also trying to solve. And so understanding how that works, right? If you're a solar developer, right, there's an opportunity. If you don't do energy efficiency at all, maybe you partner with somebody But the real opportunity is now there's money available so that if you're going into a home that has a hole in the roof, where before you couldn't put solar because there was a hole in the roof, there's money available to fix the roof, right?
Uh-huh.
To do the efficiency upgrade first and then go ahead and install the solar and a battery storage if that's what you, you know, if that's what you're doing for the consumer. And so that's a huge opportunity that, you know, I would encourage people to really take a look at because it does open up access to a market that we haven't had access to that really needs the services, right?
Right.
And that for many of us, I would say aligns with this larger vision around energy justice. And if that is what you're trying to do, then this is a huge opportunity for us to be able to do that in a really meaningful way because it is money. It's money. It's 40%. It's a $27 billion investment, right?
Wow. Yeah.
And so go through that.
That's interesting. So the greenhouse gas reduction fund.
Mm-hmm. Big one.
So
big one.
And it seems like, you know, we've said before, savvy solar installers are finding other products, other methods that in some ways are a Trojan horse for being able to sell more services, right? Like you can sell a Nest thermostat. That's easy. You could sell, you know, Vivint did this with alarm systems. Mm-hmm. A lot of electricians do it with electric. They'll, you know, get the reports on new electric vehicle owners, which is data that gets sold, and you can prospect for new electric vehicle owners and offer them an EV charging station, which often will lead to a conversation about how they're using energy in their home. Are there similar, I guess I'm curious around devices. Are there devices that excite you, like heat pumps or other things that that the trade industry should be considered, that maybe there's funding around or that the trade industry should be paying more attention to in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I don't know that there are devices that they're selling that I'm excited about necessarily, but there's certainly heat pumps is one thing trade industry needs to pay attention to. But I would also say, right, that as we're paying attention to selling heat pumps, we also need to be paying a lot of attention to maintenance of heat pumps. And so while that for business owners, that may not be a big deal, when you start thinking about policy down the road, the last thing anybody wants, right, is an administration that encourages the adoption of a particular technology, in this case, heat pumps. But people don't really know that there's a maintenance that has to happen every 10 to 12 years or whatever so that this thing is really running as efficiently as it needs to. And so they A, don't know it, or B, cannot afford it. And so now all of a sudden in 10 years or as things break down, what people will say is heat pumps stink. Like they sold me on this technology and it's right, because that's just how it goes. And so our enthusiasm sometimes to get new technology out, we forget that we have to have a plan of how do we communicate what the challenges are and the fix. And so for adoption of heat pumps, for example, when we think about adoption of heat pumps in low-income communities, we also better be thinking about where's the maintenance money coming for that heat pump so that it maintains its high efficient standard. Otherwise, we again have not really done what we thought we were doing. And so for service, you know, those kinds of technologies. But I would also say, right, for many of your listeners, if they are not involved in an alliance, in a chamber, in a C or some organization, doesn't have to be big or national, who's paying attention to these things, they should, because what you don't want, particularly as small business owners, is running in one direction because you haven't got, you know, you've got a limited amount of information about what the opportunity was, but no one's giving you the full picture. And now you're kind of stuck on one thing and then you're taking on all this stuff because you're promoting a particular technology without having the full picture. And so I think heat pumps are a great technology, but I also think people need to pay attention so that they can inform consumers when they're selling them this technology about what's required, because you're the last face that the consumer sees. And if it does not work out, then it's not just about the technology that was installed, but it's about every single, you know, they maybe do this and then the solar, and, you know, it just becomes a thing that doesn't need to happen. It becomes a monster. And so I would encourage your listeners, I would love for people to join the alliance. But if that's not the right fit, you got to be paying attention to stuff like that. You have to be paying attention to what's happening. The other point I think that people don't necessarily like to hear, certainly as it relates to efficiency, is that sometimes when you make the building efficient, you actually don't need the other technology.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And so there are examples that if you put in triple pane windows and really insulate in between your walls and make sure that all your doors are sealed and you have a really strong envelope, that it may not make sense to make the investment in a heat pump because all of those measures will have such great savings.
Yeah. But you continue using the technology you have on hand.
The technology that you already have. But that's the power of efficiency. Mm-hmm. But that's also, here's the other side of it that So maybe you don't have adoption of this, but we also don't have to build more stuff. I don't know that we're necessarily honest about our desires for new transmission lines.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
Because I was in a meeting this morning and someone shared, I don't remember what the study was, that we may need something upwards of like 72,000 miles or some crazy number of transmission lines and all the things that we need to build these lines that don't come from here, by the way.
Yeah.
And we do have a supply chain problem.
Yeah.
But just the idea, like we want to act like NIMBYism isn't a thing. I've sat through enough rate cases to tell you that NIMBYism is a thing.
Totally a thing.
And it's not necessarily a bad thing. Right. It seems bad because it's not you, but when it's your house, mm-hmm. You have to reflect and say, well, if that was my house, would I actually feel okay about that?
As we enter into a new era of grid parity, lowering LCOE cost on commercial solar projects has never been more critical. Recently, Trina Solar's TopCon 700-watt Vertex N module was awarded a bankability report by UL Solutions, proving exactly 5.8% reduction in LCOE compared to other N-type modules. Just one more reason Trina Solar is your trusted partner for total solar solutions. Visit mysuncast.com/Trina to see how a Trina Solar Vertex module can save you money today. Hey, pardon the interruption, but I wanted to just let you know how much of an impact you have on Suncast. Yeah, you. Thank you for clicking play. Without you, this show is just me shouting into the void. But there's still people who don't even know about Suncast. I know. I can hardly believe it myself. But that's where you can help me yet again. There's a simple way that you can show some love and help others discover the show. If you cruise over to www.ratethispodcast.com/suncast, I'd love it if you would leave a 5-star rating and enthusiastic review. That's possibly the single kindest thing that you could do for me today. So if the show has helped, inspired, or even entertained you at all, I'd love it if you would head over to ratethispodcast.com/suncast and give me a virtual 2 thumbs up. All right, back to today's episode.
I've spent some time, even yesterday over lunch, talking about NIMBYism. It's funny how it's NIMBYism often is, it's counterculture in that our American sort of pride is in our own capacity to decide what we want to do with our 40 acres and our mule. Right.
Exactly.
And now somebody else can step in that has 40 acres next to me and tell me what I can do with my land. Oh, man. Yeah. I mean, it is actually getting projects permitted is, I don't know how we got down this rabbit hole, but getting projects permitted is probably the number one impediment right now. It used to be interconnection. The last 2-3 years, it was interconnection. Now it's just permitting. So many people objecting to not just solar, but all technologies, wind.
All technology. Yeah.
All technologies, people afraid of change, but also wanting to protect the status quo. That's a great segue, in fact, to your move from the American Association of Blacks in Energy to Alliance to Save Energy. Because as you've said to me, ASE was an opportunity to put in place all the things that you believe in and in some cases to shake things up. So can you characterize the actual physical makeup of ASE, the staff that were there at the time, race, gender, et cetera, and maybe it wasn't an overt mandate, but the reason that you were brought in as the first female, I think, CEO, and certainly the first African-American CEO, perhaps. You talk a bit about that? You mentioned earlier this anti-DEI movement. So I want to go in that direction, challenging the status quo, but let's talk about it through the lens of ASE first.
Yeah. I mean, I think, look, ASC, when I joined the organization, we were a white organization. We had no people of color.
Yeah.
A staff, I guess, of 17 or 18 people. And very few men.
Yeah.
Maybe of 17, 4 men and 13 women. So, now, not to say that this was not a high functioning performing organization, because it was. But when I came in, the staff had a desire. The organization had a desire to diversify. So it wasn't me saying, we must diversify. You hired the Black lady and I'm coming in here to make it look different. But that was something that they had a desire to do for months and had thought about doing. And for me, it was going to be really exciting coming from an organization that had an all Black staff. And then trying to figure out, how do I do this in this new organization? And certainly having a team of people who wanted this kind of change helped tremendously, right? They weren't fighting me on it at all. They were excited about it. They wanted to learn and do more. But it still had its challenges, because it looks different and it's different people. And we had to really challenge ourselves, and our own kind of requirements and how we thought about, and a really easy example is even in our own early recruiting. We would have things that would require, a certain amount of experience and energy efficiency and stuff. And we really challenged that as a matter of diversity. And I came around and we said, listen, 4% of the energy efficiency workforce is diverse.
Wow.
So when we say that you have to have this experience, we are saying that you have to be one of the 4%.
Yeah.
And the reality is, of the 4%, why would they want to come and work at my little lonely nonprofit here in Washington, D.C., where it's expensive to live? And you're not going to be on the high end of the pay scale, right?
Right.
It doesn't make sense. But just challenging ourselves to think about how that requirement actually was counter to who we said we were completely. Like, you couldn't have this and then say you wanted something else. Were some of the challenges that we had, because we were always butting up against ourselves in many ways, right? Yeah. You have somebody that you really like, this person is great, but I have to have a diverse suite of people.
Right.
Yeah. But we need the job filled tomorrow, and we need the person in here tomorrow.
Yeah.
And here's Paula, who, you are absolutely right, you need this person tomorrow, and yet I'm going to make you wait and slow down this process because I think this other thing is more important.
I talked about this with Emily Wangerman hiring at LightSource BP, a developer, and how they intentionally slowed down the process to make sure that they were vetting all possible candidates, And honestly, we have to remember that, generally men, and also privileged folks in status, whether they be men of any race, like Stanford and Harvard grads, are going to be more confident in themselves to present themselves as candidates, right? Mm-hmm. They're going to act more quickly. They're going to have people who refer them with good references and great credentials. Doesn't necessarily mean that they're the best hire.
Right. And we like to hire from those places.
Yeah.
Because they're familiar. Maybe I went to Stanford, or I didn't go to Stanford or Harvard, but maybe you did. We just have to, I think my journey at the Alliance has been, it's been challenging for everybody, including me, which also was surprising, right? And since we started out this conversation transparently, and I know we're going to end soon, we're going to end with another transparent Paula moment.
Yeah.
Because certainly for me, as a Black woman, I was highly aware and highly sensitive to the fact that there were people who were going to be looking at my choices of people to bring in and decide that I brought in this person who was Black because I was Black, and that was the only reason why they were here. And I absolutely had occasion to worry about if people thought I was hiring too many Black people in the organization. Mm. And I heard that
no way.
With my third hire.
Oh, yeah.
It didn't take that many before people started to feel like, well, maybe it's too much.
Too fast.
And I remember thinking, wow, it's three and it's too much, right? And not because this person, maybe these people were racist or anything. It was because it looked and felt different. Mm-hmm. Because with shared culture, right? We had, we thought about things differently. And I'm just, last example, at one point, I'm assuming you know who DMX is, the rapper.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So when DMX passed and we did our staff meetings and everybody talked, but no one said anything about DMX. And I will say, I got off the phone a little disturbed. Because I kept thinking, how is no one mentioning DMX?
Yeah.
And so in a future meeting, what I said to the team is like, listen, at my previous organization, like our meeting probably would have started with a word about DMX because we were all in that. And so I just shared with them. I said, so like for me, it was a little surprised that we didn't talk about it, but I get it because that was my thing. I said, but I'm going to share it so that we all feel comfortable. Like this is something like DMX passing actually is a big deal to me. Not that I was weeping, but like, you know,
it's a cultural icon. DMX.
He was a cultural icon. And so it was very interesting because when I said to the team, they were like, oh yeah, that's right. You know? And it is, so it does get to, as when we talked at the beginning, like this idea of being a leader and what does it mean to be authentic and vulnerable and transparent and all this other stuff. I believe that if I am unable to show up that way, I cannot possibly have a reasonable expectation that anybody else will show up that way.
Yeah.
But that when I do and they do, right, we have to be prepared and open and okay with that result.
Yeah.
Right. You can't invite people in, then they come, and then you say, oh, I'm sorry. Not that you. The other you is the one I wanted to come in. Right. You can't have it both ways. And so this whole journey that we've had at the Alliance of not just diversifying our team, but really changing our team to meet a new moment.
Yeah.
Has been about how do we do it in a way that allows people to come in the way that they are. And has made us really focus on our culture and what does it mean to fit and not focus as much on what do you know, right? But how can we work with one another? What is that? Yeah. What does that relationship look like? You know, I often, when we do new hires and I meet with our new hires, I always tell them, first thing I always tell them is, please know that this is not an interview to see if you are qualified.
Yeah.
You're qualified because you're here. You already passed that test. I'm not going to ask you questions about if you're qualified, has nothing to do with me. This is an interview about fit.
Yeah.
And do you fit? And if you're interviewing with me, I always also say, I encourage you to ask me as many questions. If I were you, I would want to know, how does Paula think about leadership, about this organization? What is her vision? How does she think about remote and hybrid work? How does she feel about vacation time and taking vacation time? Like if I were you, and everyone who interviews me will tell you, I tell them, I'm like, you should be asking me and know all of these questions.
Cheat code right here if you're thinking about interviewing.
This is about fit as much as it is about what you know.
That's right.
It is about, is this going to be a good place for you? Because if it's not a good place for you as a future employee, it's certainly not going to be good for me as your future boss. Because you're not going to give me your best, because I'm not giving you what you need to give me your best. And we have to kind of get there.
You said something to me in a conversation we had recently that 2023 was the year you decided to show up in the job. What does it mean to show up and own the job?
Yeah, and for me, it meant really believing that I had the authority to make the decisions that I was making. And that I actually didn't need anybody's permission to make those decisions, because I had that authority. I was in that role. I was hired for that role. And I had to, sometimes not second guess myself, the imposter syndrome, worrying about who's going to be mad at me because they don't like my decision. Some people will be upset with you.
Right.
And working all that stuff through.
Now you're the CEO. Do you feel like that's something that every person in the organization ought to also feel?
I don't know. I think it would be disingenuous to say that everybody should feel like they have the same level of authority and decision making as I do, because they don't.
Yeah.
They do have their own autonomy in their role in decision making. And I try to encourage that as much as I can. And my style of encouragement is probably not what people like, but I'm definitely the great ignorer. If you ask me for a question that I know you can answer yourself, I will ignore you, because I know that eventually you will get sick of waiting on me and you will answer the question yourself. And I'm always, for my team, I always say, I hired you because I believe that you know what you're doing. So you don't need me to tell you what you're doing, because if I have to tell you what to do, then actually that was not the good decision. I'm not smart that I know all that stuff.
How do you toe the line then between affirmation and confirmation?
So here's what I think. You start with thank you all the time. Right. So my theory is, as a CEO, the team gets all the credit for the good stuff. Good stuff is to the credit of the entire team.
Yeah.
Bad stuff falls on me.
Yeah.
I own the bad stuff. They get the credit for the good stuff.
Yeah.
Because the reality is that even though people are giving me the credit, I actually didn't do it. And I know I didn't do it. I have a team of people who did all this amazing work that people thank me publicly for.
Yeah.
But I didn't do it. On the other side of that, though, if something did not get done and I am the leader, that is my responsibility. It's my responsibility to make sure that I'm in communication with my team and I know what's happening. And if I'm not doing that and something pops up, that's kind of on me.
Yeah.
Right. And if they're not telling me and I'm not doing anything about that, that also is kind of on me. Right. And so that philosophy also, though, right, I think has allowed my team to feel a greater sense of autonomy. Because you're not going to get in trouble if you made a mistake, right? We're doing all this stuff together. And you know, we started this conversation. I told you, I believe I had a career that's been lined with grace.
Yeah.
Great grace and gratitude. And so being able to say thank you to people when they've done something, not a great job. Thank you. Thank you for doing this for me because, you know, it was received well. Thank you because I know I asked you at the last minute. And you obviously had to take something off your plate or rearrange something to make this happen for me. Thank you for doing that. Even if that is their responsibility, I think, you know, starting with a thank you and acknowledging when people do well, something, man, that takes you a long daggone way. And then the other piece is like, yes, that is your decision to make. If it was a bad decision, how do we pivot? And so, at Abe, my team, and now at the Alliance, right? And I started this last year. At Abe, our team, we had a theme. Every year as a team, we had one team professional goal that we were all working on. Mm-hmm. And one year, right before COVID, our theme was the pivot. We had to, as a team, learn how to pivot because we had an occasion where something did not turn out. And we spent a lot of time being mad and running around as opposed to collapsing around the problem and learning how to pivot. And it benefited us because the next year we had COVID. And it was like, oh, look, we get to exercise this pivot muscle, and now we really have to figure some stuff out. When I last year decided that this was my job, we celebrated hip hop. And that's actually how I got there. I was like, you know, it's the 50th anniversary of hip hop. And I was a New York City kid when hip hop started. I remember when hip hop started. I remember seeing, you know, LL Cool J and on all these guys. And so I decided, you know, that celebration was so representative of who I am as a person and the things that I value and the way that I was raised and the things that I celebrate about me and my existence. And it gave me an opportunity to once share that with my board. And that I had a board that really received it well and was enthusiastic about my shenanigans and my weird one-off quirky kind of things of like, we're not going to clap this year. We're only going to raise the roof. You know, it's affirming for me to have a board that when I say that, they say, okay, we'll do that. You know, it's not a big deal. We're not even going to ask you a question. You say raise the roof. We're raising the roof at every single meeting until it's over.
I love it.
But like all of that, right, allowed me to say, okay, so I have to show up at this job, which means I have to lead the way that I want to lead or the way that I would like someone to be my leader. I have to own and take full accountability for all of the mistakes, no matter who made them and all the failures, no matter why there was a failure. Those are mine because I'm owning this job.
Yeah.
That means that belongs to me. And I have to celebrate my team when things go well and when they do great stuff. And like what I've learned is that the minute you start being grateful for what people give to you, they give you more.
That's amazing.
Because people want to be appreciated. And they should be. I know how good it feels when someone says, man, you did a great job. Thank you so much for coming to speak to this group of people and mentoring for 10 minutes. And I would say, well, let's just ask them to come and talk to some folks. And that's actually not a big deal.
Right.
But the fact that someone said, no, you took your time and did this for me and I appreciate it is meaningful to me. So why would it not be meaningful to somebody who works for me or works on my team for me to say, that event you put together, I need you to know that the feedback that I have gotten has been tremendous.
Yeah.
Folks are saying that this was a great time. Blah, 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 blah. Let's do more of this. I don't lose anything from that. I gain from that. And it's the right thing to do.
You mentioned that. Yeah. I'm going to riff off a little bit of what is one of the things that you said. You mentioned that You grew up when hip hop was getting started, and we're, you know, this is the 50th anniversary year of hip hop. And I'm curious, how, as a child of hip hop, do you view hip hop as more than rap?
Yeah, because it's everything. It is art. It is dance. It's Crush Groovin' with Shabba-Doo, and it's graffiti arts, and it's like, it's fashion, it's cross cultural. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know if people remember like Cross Colors, For Us, By Us, like mm-hmm. all of that started, right, with hip hop. And then honestly, some of our first really big Black billionaires and millionaires, right, Jay-Z, right, they were hip-hop artists. Mm. You know, they were guys who took their craft and realized that even when someone else didn't think it was a business, they knew it had some value. They knew it had value, right?
Yeah.
So I'll build my own thing,
yeah.
Right? I don't need, you know, all this other stuff. So, like, to me, that gift of a generation, my generation, Gen X, of hustle and recognizing your worth and seeing art as more than just art, right? Like, how amazing is it that the commercials today about pharmaceuticals and fair pricing on our hospital bill is coming from Fat Joe and all these guys who are now my age, because we all 55 and 60 years old, Busta Rhymes, we old people now. Like, how amazing is it that we are now the Social Security set? Like, we're the folks who are in AARP and talking about, right? Always been talking about social issues, right? But they've changed because we've gotten older.
Yeah.
And I just,
what hasn't changed is Busta Rhymes can still spit rhymes.
Right. Busta can spit.
He's so good. Yeah. He's so good. Similarly, you are in the world of energy efficiency, and we're talking about blending these cultural fabric. How is energy efficiency like hip hop?
Oh God, because it's for everybody. Very much like hip hop, I might add, right? Mm-hmm. If you think about the origins of hip hop, just being this thing in the Bronx, right? Yeah. And all of a sudden now, one day we have the Beastie Boys, and hip hop isn't just for Black people anymore, right? It expands and it grows, and it's like, oh, there are lots of audiences that this actually kind of resonates with. And then you have breakdancing. And now we have So You Think You Can Dance, right? And like, think about how, right? And then Jabba walks on, right, doing a residency in Las Vegas. And so when we think about efficiency and this, you know, our conversation about an energy transition and constantly changing to meet the needs of people in this moment and what people need and desire, that's what efficiency does.
Yeah.
That's absolutely what we do. And 45 years ago, we talked about conservation and load management. And today we talk about energy efficiency, but we are still talking about the same kind of stuff with new technologies and new ways of doing things, right? So all we've done, just like hip hop, has transitioned to meet the needs of today and speak the language of people today.
Yeah.
The language of people today. Mm. I think that's what efficiency does, right? We can meet all of these other needs when we speak that language.
We had a good laugh on when, I can't remember when we were chatting, but you said, I hate it when people say energy jobs are sexy. Nobody at Google says their job is sexy.
Nobody says any job is sexy.
So
it's not.
So So explain a bit why you think that's BS and how it's lazy. And then I'd love for you to suggest alternative language.
Yeah. Oh, I know my language. I mean, I do think it's lazy because I don't think that anyone is walking around saying we need to make this job sound sexy. It's work, right? And the only jobs that are sexy that you're working at are not. We know what they are.
Yeah, like, let's get real. Like, banks won't fund it.
Right. So I think like using that as an excuse for why people don't join our industry is just lazy. It's because we haven't made any kind of effort. Yeah. It's because we actually don't really recruit creatively. It's because we have had an industry where if your dad worked there or your grandfather or your mom, whoever, that's how people came in. I'm not saying there's anything wrong or right about that. That is the reality of how it has gone. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so to now say that, well, we're not sexy like Microsoft. There are lots of people who work at Microsoft who will not tell you that that place was sexy. That is not why they decided to work in tech. And so, yeah, I think it's just a lazy way of saying, hey, I didn't really make a huge effort in doing my recruiting. But because I did minimal and no one's running towards me. It's because I'm not sexy and all these other people are doing great things. And while that may have worked pre-pandemic when we had nap pods in our offices and ping pong tables and such and such and so, that is certainly not the case today where people don't even want to go back into the office. So it cannot be about sexy. It's got to be about something else. Maybe meaningful work, you know, maybe great engagement with people. Like, maybe that's what it is. But what I have suggested people that is that energy efficiency, energy, it's dope.
It's dope.
Don't have to be so. It's dope.
Back to that's better.
You know, my young children tell me that dope is not the way we don't say that anymore. I don't care. It's dope. Everybody knows what it means, right? Yeah. You don't. If you ask me, what does dope mean? I probably couldn't give you a meaning. But when I say it's dope, you know what it means. You're like, oh, okay, it's better than fill in the blank, right? It's fulfilling. It must be kind of fun. You know, there must be some kind of cool people who work there if it's dope. Like, what is that? Like, what is that? Right. But whatever that is, I think efficiency brings that to this industry.
Yeah,
I do. And I think, you know, we want to bring people into our business, stop telling them, talking about sexiness, because that's just, to me, makes no sense.
I love it. I love it. And we need a t-shirt that says efficiency is dope.
Efficiency is dope. It is. And I'll tell you, I've said that before, and I've had people come up to me like, just this week, last week, I still remember that speech. And I tell people efficiency is dope. I was like, it is
that's
dope.
That's so good.
Tell people I love that. It. If for no other reason, because no one's ever heard it before. That's enough.
When you think about new energy voices, then you've been able to empower and inspire and mentor folks as they've come up in their careers. Who inspires you? You mentioned Naomi Davis.
Naomi Davis from Blacks in Green. She's inspiring. Dr. Anthony Kinslow from Genesis, who does, you know, he's just inspiring. I just really enjoy meeting him. Gilbert Campbell, at Volt Solar Utilities, and his partner Anton. Like, there's just so many young people
who are
doing things.
Tell me about Naomi, Blacks and Green.
Yeah. I mean, I love Naomi's sustainable square mile idea, right? Mm-hmm. That, what I really admire about her is here's a person who didn't work in energy 30 years and then decide to do this, right? But she made a decision that this was important and then tried to figure out how do I build this thing that I want, right? That I want my community to be sustainable, that people don't have to move, that we should have, like, we can grow our food here and we can show people what green housing, like, we can do this here. That is such a huge undertaking in any community.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about a piece of Chicago, which is urban, which means there are lots of people. It's dense. And like, I remember hearing the idea and then she bought a building, right? And then she had the Green Living Room and had an event with the Green, which is like a community center that she calls the Green Living Room, and an Airbnb. And she's growing collard greens and vegetables in the back.
She's got a DOE grant.
And she's got DOE grant, right? So now she's she's providing technical assistance, and she has two more buildings that she's trying to redo. And so to watch her purposefully and really single-mindedly say, this is the vision that I want, a sustainable square mile in my community of Chicago. And so I'm going to do what I can and take my talent, of which is many, and bring in people to sell that vision to, who then bought into it and believed in it so that they want to support it. I admire her for her ability to do that. I think that's an amazing thing. I admire people who build stuff, because that's not something I can do. I don't think I would ever be a good entrepreneur. I can do this. But people who start from scratch and build things, like you, like Naomi, I admire people who can do that, because I know I could never do that. Like, I just, every time I see it, I'm like, I don't know how you have the wherewithal, the energy, the hustle,
the energy and hustle is waning. I'll tell you that. I was glad I started in my 30s.
So when I, you know, see people who do that kind of work, you know, another person though that I really deeply admire is Holmes Humble from Clean Energy Works. And their, again, steadfastness to an idea to have inclusive utility financing for energy efficiency, solar. Like, you know, their ability to have this idea when we met, what, 10, 12 years ago, and now to make it into this, right, company, organization, and projects, and operating in different states, and having states wanting to adopt your financial tool to roll out and engage more people. And, you know, for anyone who's ever met Holmes, you know how brilliant they are. And just how smart they are, and the level of commitment that they have, again, to people who are often forgotten. So that would be another person that I would say I deeply admire.
There's two more folks that I want to talk about before we wrap. One, and it happens to be two male leaders that you and I have discussed before. One is a great example of a strong character. Black CEO, and the other is was counterintuitive. I asked you, who are the people that are doing it right? You know, in Black History Month, everyone tends to point to Black leaders, and you said it doesn't have to be that way. There's examples of white people that get it, and you pointed to someone that I'd never actually even heard of, a guy named Steve. Would you talk a bit about why he was the example you shared with me?
What I really enjoy, Steve Mitnick, who is the owner, I think, and editor-in-chief of Public Utilities Fortnightly. His publication is beyond just well-received. It's been around more than 90 years. He has an extensive energy background, very well-revered. And in February, he would often do something to celebrate Thomas Edison's birthday, because Thomas Edison was born in February. And, you know, he got feedback. I was certainly one of them who talks about, like, but it's still Black History Month. And, like, this is great about Thomas Edison, but it's Black History Month. Like, it's the only time it's Black History Month. And what about Lewis Latimer? And he then took it on himself to research and write a book about Lewis Latimer. And so for your listeners, if you do not know who Lewis Latimer is, he is the reason why Thomas Edison's stuff works. He created the carbon filament and 10,000 other kinds of patents for telephone and electricity. He was a brilliant man.
He's also the patent writer.
And, you know, when you read his book, you will learn a lot about his relationship with Thomas Edison. Some of it not as great as you would want, you know, because it's history. Like, in context matters. And this was, you know, come on now.
So Mitnick ended up writing a book on Latimer.
Wrote a book on it. He established a scholarship in Lewis Latimer's name. He actually then was able to connect with Lewis Latimer's family. His home is still existing in Queens, while it's been moved from the neighborhood that it was in, which was Cambria Heights, and moved to Flushing. And they have a STEM education center there to bring in students from all over New York City. And so, right, it is to say that that bit of curiosity, right, spread tremendous amounts of knowledge to people who would have probably never known anything about Lewis Latimer. But a comment led to his curiosity, led to a book, that led to probably, if Lewis Latimer had a fan club, Steve Mitnick would absolutely be the president, because he knows so much about him and his family's history. And he cares deeply about that story and making sure that we understand the full story, and everybody's contributions. And so, it is important to acknowledge all, you know, the reality is that the progress that we have made in this country from slavery and beyond did not just happen with just Black people. It just didn't, right? And it's not going to happen now.
I'll link to
one group.
I'll link to Steve's his page on Fortnightly, and you'll see that Steve is clearly not a young man anymore.
No, he's an amazing guy, though.
But taking into context that he. Sort of later in life, having been through, like my parents and yours, segregation and more, was open to the truth and embracing it. I love that like you said, he'd be the president of Lewis Latimer's fan club. We did an article.
There's an interesting story in that he tells in this book about Lewis Latimer's father, George Latimer, who was enslaved and ran away, I believe, to Philadelphia. And when his owners caught up to him and went, and they did, they sued his father, George Latimer, for theft, for stealing himself.
Yeah.
Because he was their property. And so imagine being sued for stealing you. And so like the amount of research that Steve did for this book and the just the interesting stuff that you learn about people generally speaking, and history, right? Yeah. Like that's just history. I was like, who would have ever thought that? Is why we are all involved in this. So people really encourage people to take a look at it.
Yeah. I'll link for folks to a post we did 2 years ago, featuring Lewis Latimer, and then a video I found of Steve telling the story of the legacy of Lewis Latimer, which is really cool. Yeah, so I'll link for folks to check that out. And then the other is Dan Packer. Tell me why Dan Packer stands out for you as a
So Dan Packer passed several weeks ago, and you know the American Association of Blacks and Energy that I had the opportunity to be the CEO of is the organization that's kept me in this industry for 30 plus years. And he specifically was the very first person I met in this organization 30 years ago. I went to a conference 31 years ago, in fact, got on an elevator. He at that time was president of Entergy New Orleans. And he was friendly and warm and just kind of sucked me into this group, and has been that person in my life for 30 plus years. He, you know, sideways approved when I married the second time. He pulled that fella aside and said, yeah, you are the right person for her. And what my husband would say is that that meant something to him as well, because he knew here was someone that I really loved. I loved dearly. Yeah. He was also, though, so people have a little more color about him, right? He was the president first, I think, first African-American to be president of Entergy New Orleans.
Yeah.
And subsequently, I think every president of Entergy New Orleans has been, it's been African-American. He was the first African-American to be the plant manager of a nuclear plant in this country, Millstone in Connecticut. He's done a lot of firsts. He's been the first. He was a Navy guy. Lost his first wife. He was a widow, very young, and raised his children alone for a while until he remarried, at a time where you didn't see a lot of that either.
Yeah.
And then he was just incredibly kind. And really he enjoyed this work. He led Entergy New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina. And so, you know, oftentimes when you read his bio, people talk about like, here's a person who led during Hurricane Katrina, which was right at that point, the worst disaster we had ever seen. But imagine being a CEO who not only has to get the lights back on in an unimaginable, situation.
Yeah.
And getting his employees to do all that work. These are the same people who also lost their homes.
Yeah.
Who had families who had to leave the state and relocate, who didn't know if they were ever going to be able to rebuild. He had to do that and think about that with his own family, and still stay focused on the customers of New Orleans and making sure that people were taken care of. And in that, I think, is why I just so deeply admire him. Right.
Yeah.
Because what does that say about that is the definition of service. And I might suggest as we think about and talk, create narratives about, our utility workers, most of them are like Dan. Most of them are not thinking about, I know this, they're not thinking about their families. And we often forget that their families are in the same situation that we are in as customers when there's an outage. They're dealing with the same stuff. But actually, they prioritize us, and he absolutely prioritized other people and customers. And at the same time, trying to deal with the personal stuff. You have a family, you have kids, you have all this other stuff. So really special, special person to me.
Fantastic! What a legacy.
Yeah.
How, if folks are so inclined, someone listening today wants to reach out to you. They want to thank you. They want to show gratitude for the time that you spent with us. How could they do that?
They can email me at pglover@asc.org. You can also reach out to me at LinkedIn. I think you have history. You know, if you reach out to me at LinkedIn, I will respond, right?
Absolutely.
You can amplify that I have done that twice.
Yeah.
And I would love if there is something that I can do that can be helpful.
Yeah.
Right. Reach out to me. If I can't help you, I'll tell you. Don't be mad if I tell you that I actually can't help you.
Totally.
But
I'll tell you.
You know.
I'll tell you. I'll be the first. You got to help me get Gilbert on. Gilbert Campbell, we're calling you out.
Gilbert. He's overseas now, so he's not hearing this. But
I can't pretend. I can't pretend that Gilbert listens to all of my episodes, but he's going to listen to this one because I'm going to send it to him. Be like, hey, you got to listen to Paula's story.
You'll love her.
You'll love her. I'll listen all the way to the end. Well, in that vein, you already have a 25-year history in the industry. Who knows? Could be another 25 years before you hang up your spurs, so to speak. But what do you want to be your legacy?
Can I tell you, I already got it.
Mm?
I want to hear something crazy. It's not a long story, but sure. My mom died 9 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I was really heartened. I think one of the things about her funeral that really made me feel good, and she was 90, was that people that she had worked with 40 years ahead of time, 40 years, wrote us letters. If they did not come to her funeral, they wrote us letters talking about what kind of person she was. Your mother helped me when I had this problem with XYZ. When I had a boss who did XYZ, your mom called so-and-so and made that. Like, and no one really knew, but she was that person. And the legacy that I actually want to leave is somebody saying that about me. Mm. And that is actually, to start with yourself, you are enough, that's enough.
Yeah.
Right? I hope I have, and I think I will have huge impact. But what I really want is for somebody to be able to say, you know, I reached out to her and she was able to help me in a teeny tiny way. She referred me to XYZ. She listened. I don't know that I can contribute more than that. But if I give that, I will be beyond satisfied with my work, my career. It's enough.
What a pleasure and a treasure to spend time with Paula. Paula, thank you once again for investing in the lives of our solar warriors and climate champions. Thank you as well for taking the time to listen all the way through to the end of this conversation. Not lost on me that you have carved out the only thing that you won't give back. So I just wanted to acknowledge that you're still here. If you're still hanging on, there are ways that you can dig deeper. I've mentioned some links to the video of Steve on Lewis Latimer, and I've got a bunch of other links that I dug up in the process of researching for this episode. I'll make sure to leave those for you, including the 50th anniversary of hiphop.com, a website that can tell you more about 50th anniversary. There are a number of ways that you could connect with us, but I would dare say that the number one way I prefer is LinkedIn. Paula just mentioned that she's available as well there. Please go over to LinkedIn. We'll leave the link for that in the description so that you can both comment on posts I no doubt have made about this phenomenal episode, but send us a direct message. I know that Paula as well agrees that if we can help you in some way, we will try to do so. I'd like to say thank you as well to our sponsors who help make sure that the only thing you have to pay is attention and give us some of your time. They take care of the rest by helping finance this organization. Thank you so much for leaning in with us and believing in the audience that shows up every week as our solar warriors here for SunCat. If you would like to find ways to reach our audience the same way they do, well, go to mysuncast.com/sponsor. And while you're there, click through on the offers that we've linked for them and let them know that you heard about them on SunCast. Remember, you are what you listen to. Thanks again for showing up, Solar Warriors. It's half the battle.